We'll open it up for questions and discussion. We have a couple students, I think, that are going to be, staff, that are going to be helping out with microphones. So any questions, comments? Courtney.
Usually use these. Have you uncovered any evidence that private practice physicians during the Great Depression increased the charity care they provided, or just because of perhaps decreased demand, decreased the fees that they charged, so that maybe there was a hidden safety net developed?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't have exact statistics. It's mostly anecdotal. Physicians' incomes overall went down dramatically during the Depression, but it didn't mean they weren't providing care for people. They certainly had a wide variety of, you know, sliding scale options and sometimes provided free care. I did also find that physicians in Chicago during the Depression worked for the county. So the county, Cook County, created a physician service that was subsidized, and those physicians worked for very low pay. So yes, definitely there was a private safety net and a public safety net of physicians, as well as the clinics.
And you have reason to believe that this developed during the 30s that didn't exist prior?
Oh, no. This was there was a long tradition of charity care dating back to the 19th century. And I would say that over time, by the 40s, it had declined significantly already. I would say the most precipitous drop came in the 20s as medical care began to be seen as more of a business. Charity values continued to be important to the medical profession, but they really started to decline in the 20s. So I think there's some continuity there.
So continuity, but not an increase in the 30s. So perhaps they didn't step up, so to speak.
You could say that. I would have to back that up with some more research, but my sense is, and you know, I don't want to make them the bogeyman, but they were obstructionists when it came to the development of a safety net in the 30s, and I think I kind of indicated that in my talk, that a lot of the reasons for the limitations of the safety net were due to physician opposition. And they understandably were trying to maintain their fee base that was, you know, also under attack. And they were losing so much income, so it's part of that pattern.
Other questions? Here's one. Maureen. Luann.
Those were both very fascinating and stimulating narratives. A question I had, in the particulars with respect to the history in Chicago, was public health involved in this, governmental public health? And a more general question, do you see any possibility for public health addressing some of these organizational or vision issues? Are they part of the problem, or do they offer any promise of contributing?
That's a loaded question.
Mm-hmm. I'll take the easy part of that question. Yes, the city public health services were involved. They were part of the clinic system. The municipal tuberculosis and venereal disease clinics were both run by the Chicago Public Health authorities, and their role was very important during this time. It didn't change as much as I expected during the 30s. And like I said, they were part of this sort of continuum between public and private among Chicago clinics. Do they have a more important role to play?
Rosemary? Well, certainly should. But I want to turn that back and say, and ask, how would you answer that?
Well, one of the important things you noted, I think, with that turn of phrase about the physicians having an investment in health much as the auto industry does in clean air, in effect. And so I think that vision of health is a central focus, that public health would provide that. I think also I was wondering about, in terms of public health, trying to integrate, I think, some of the other players more so now as we talk about a public health system. So really trying to work on leadership and a conceptualization of how we build a broader and integrated public health system, which incorporates players outside that include medical care, but also include social services, that include local government, that include housing and schools. So that
right.
Is there a chance really to kind of nest a look at this and create that sort of vision of possibility that it might address those broader kinds of concerns?
There's certainly a possibility. I mean it's, but you mentioned leadership. And this would be a good place for leadership to be developed. And one of the things I was thinking about when reading about Michael M. Davis for this session was how important leadership is. You know, new Michael Davises, Isidore Fox, other people who provide a stimulus, maybe working with some of the foundations to get the message out. And I wondered whether we do need a kind of new national committee on, what was it called, Beatrice? The National Commission. No, the other, he was a medical director, he was a director of a national healthcare commission. Whether it isn't time, I think it is time for there to be some concerted action, but it does need individuals with some stature to be in there and do things. The Institute of Medicine, through its report, you know, the whole thing about reinventing public health in new terms is important. But I think one really needs some private, individual, and then joint actions, which are aside from the think tanks generally. So because you are talking about really a reinvention of public health. I mean, public health has been reinvented before to include medical care and medical care issues, and. Public health has obviously become very much in view, although it was neglected for some time. It's become, as a field, it's come into view because of all the necessary background services one needs in case of disaster of many different kinds, including epidemics, but other disasters as well. So if there's some way of really rebuilding the idea of public health beyond including but beyond state, federal, state, and local people who regard themselves as members of a public health profession. But I don't know how to do that. I think we need new leaders coming up. I'm now old guard. But we do need some effective, prominent people to do it.
I wonder if, it seems that in our, that's maybe perhaps one area where history has changed. So in the early part of the 20th century, the medical profession, I think, really tried to clamp down on public health and it was kind of seemed to be a turf issue. I wondered about your opinions about this, that, you know, they really wanted public health to be about sanitation.
Yes.
And not about medical care. Mm. And I have an impression that today that's different, that the medical profession is not as concerned about protecting, keeping public health down, that there's more collaboration, and perhaps that would lend itself to leadership in this kind of new vision of an integrated mm-hmm. system. I don't know mm-hmm. what you think about that.
I think there's a good point. I mean, really, the rise in prominence of Medicaid has been quite exciting. Now, of course, with the state with the budgetary crunch, you would know more about what's happening than I would on what's happening in Medicaid provision in the states. But I think Medicaid and Medicaid's professionalism, in a way, and the increasing role of expertise at the state level, you know, back in the 1960s, there was a general feeling that nobody who worked in state government was any good. Whether or not that was true, there was a feeling that people who were running health and welfare and social programs at the state level were not people at the top of the profession. And that perception and our reality, I think, has changed enormously. What do you think, though, about that, Colleen?
Well, sitting in the state of Illinois with Governor Blagojevich, it does give me pause. But but yes, I definitely think it's changed, especially the state agencies. The level of professionalism, I think, has improved enormously. And I think just in general, people have a much greater respect for the workings of state government. Mm-hmm. So I would agree with that. Enough of me, though. Any other more questions?
If history can teach us anything about the new retail clinics that are popping up, and they're national chains like Walmart, and then locally based Walgreens here, and how they might help work on the access and organizational issues, what their role is, and can history teach us anything about that?
Retail clinics?
Yeah, you go to Walmart to get a flu shot, or because you've got a cough, or you want some antibiotics or something. They have a sort of a menu of things that they will do often. In the 90s, there was this whole Doc in the Box thing, where there were little clinics being set up all over the place. I guess I have two responses to this. One goes back to Michael Davids, whose paid clinics were open in the evening or the weekend. I mean, they were geared to working people. So there's a demand, clearly. People are using these kinds of things, so it says something about the need for more imaginative forms of care. In terms of, it's just convenient, you happen to be in Walmart or in CVS or somewhere else, and you don't have anything very important, and you may not have a primary care doctor, or you may have a doctor who you don't want to bother, or you don't get on very well with. So there is a demand for off-hours care, convenient care. At the same time, these services emphasize the way in which healthcare's got split up into different sections, and nobody's keeping... Only the patient can keep track of all of this. So you get your flu shot maybe in your apartment house. You go and you take your sick child to get some antibiotics, which is, I look forward to seeing some evaluations of what is exactly happening they're small primary care, but they're boutique clinics because they're not claiming to do comprehensive primary care. They're only doing certain things, certain common things that people might need. So I think it's both a reflection both of need for more accessible health care in the population, and it's also a reflection of something about primary care and the lack of primary care.
I agree that it really fits what Rosemary was talking about the lack of coordination in the system, and how when new programs arise, it's not due to any sort of coordinated planned effort on the part of the U.S. as a nation. They emerge in a very haphazard fashion, and that certainly describes the safety net. No one ever sat down and planned what the U.S. healthcare safety net would look like. And this is an example of something that was lacking in the system, availability after work, low-cost clinic services that was met by the private sector. So I think it really fits a lot of the themes that we both talked about mm-hmm. today.
Why don't you introduce yourself as well when you ask a question? It'd be nice to get to know one another. Thank you.
I'm Steve Andes. I teach at with Northwestern now.
Not done.
Both of you talked about a need to coordinate a system, and right now, as this system runs out of money, which is driving one of the reasons we're even here today, we can't keep paying for this. Do you see Do you see a government mechanism arising? Do you see a voluntary system arising? Do you see a market-based system arising? Even you both mentioned that in the Progressive Era, in the New Deal, that issue was debated and pushed under the table. But what do you see happening as we really start screeching out of cash?
I think my views, it has to be a combination of government and business or market, because we've gone unless the economy totally crashes and we're back in like the Great Depression. But even in the Great Depression, there was a decision not to push for national health insurance. But unless the economy crashes or we get more and more infrastructure funds, which might provide free money, as it were, funds for developing further coordinated programs, healthcare delivery programs, it has to be by a coordination among different interests. That's not a very good reply, and I have to think some more about that, but maybe somebody can help us out on that. Can somebody help us out? What would you do to help coordinate the healthcare system?
Solve the problem.
Yeah.
All right, I have to chime in just because you used the word money. I am looking for some commentary or feedback or reflection, but there's a couple background points I just want to point out. Becky Bush, by the way, and I do a lot of healthcare auditing work as far as an introduction. One of the quotes that I found really interesting that I came across was one from 1910 from a magazine called The Insurance Monitor. And I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was something to the effect that there's no way private insurance world is going to get into health insurance because the dynamics and the disorganization of it is so prone to waste, fraud, and abuse that they'd rather stick to insuring death, which is much more predictable. But your comments in both of your presentations is helping me look at a question that I've been trying to get my hands around from a different box. I've been tracking monetary expenditures from like 1920 to current day, and it's really interesting the influx between the government private side, and my theory on why Medicare, Medicaid even came about is because the flood of money into the system from employer-sponsored programs left a group of people where the haves and the have-nots was so extreme between employees versus those who were unemployed, small business, the elderly, the poor, what have you, that is part of what drove the response. So my question goes back to your comments on health insurance and organization. I feel that monetary policy results in a lot of bizarre behaviors in the market. The one that I'm tracking a lot is the private side, and because their transactions are considered proprietary, they're not transparent, as opposed to Medicare, Medicaid, or the public programs. It's all public information. So you can have one organization that has to respond to providing health care services in which they're being funded by proprietary dollars and public dollars. So I guess my question really goes back to transparency and the impact that could have in answering some of these questions or issues that you brought up.
I think the insurers are going to be very important because they are, you know, much of the money flows through the private insurers. And businesses too, who are going to be grappling increasingly with, what to do about worker insurance and even retiree insurance. So how one manipulates money streams, or how one manipulates is a bad word, but how one tries to use money streams creatively, which meet the needs of more than one group. Which meet the needs of insurers. I mean, insurers would love to have a better healthcare system, I think, if it was to their, you know, if it was something they were involved with and could work with. Isn't it no one's interest to have this disorganized healthcare system going forward? Before we leave, by the way, I want to say something about the advantages of our system. There are some pluses.
then up here and over here.
Oh, okay. Am I next? Okay. My name is Helen Redman. I work in the ER at Stroger Hospital. And so we're really on the front lines of this massive healthcare crisis. And the wait times in our emergency room are over 20 hours on certain days. So everything, much of what you said, Dr. Hoffman, it's a reality in this country. We have people who show up and they have stage 3 cancers. They've never been treated. So it's really the human suffering is it's still there, and it's really it's heartbreaking. And in my opinion, it's unnecessary. I just want to make a few quick points. We have one of the stingiest, most uncomprehensive healthcare system, or even welfare states in the world, actually. And healthcare, I think, is just one of them, means tested, not really comprehensive at all. And when I look at the history of healthcare in this country, I look at it as a clash between powerful interests and the American people. And the powerful interests, you mentioned some of them, and that is the private insurance industry and the AMA. And the AMA really has played an obstructionist role from the beginning. They opposed Medicare, they opposed Medicaid, and they were really more concerned about their own power and prestige. But that really has changed in the last decade or so. We have Physicians for a National Health Program, and they have many members, and they're for a national health care program. So doctors, in my eyes, have redeemed themselves because they actually want health care as a human right now. And so my answer to this crisis is single payer. We have a bill in Congress. We have two bills, one in the Senate and one in the House, H.R. 676, which has been put forward by John Conyers. And the American people, the majority of the American people, want government controlled insurance. They want the abolition of the private insurance industry. That is the core of the problem, and that is the fight. And as a social worker, I believe healthcare is a human right. It's not a commodity, and that's what I think social workers need to bring to this national debate. We need to make our voices heard that healthcare is a human right and it's not a commodity. So if you could comment on that.
I agree. it's easier for me to say, when people ask me, as the gentleman did earlier, what do you think should happen, what do you think will happen? What will happen, I think, is going to be different than what I think should happen. Single payer as an ideal is my ideal, but the question I ask in my work is, how do we get there, given the powerful interests that you describe, given the fact that we have a very heavily private and public system that's mixed? And my answer to that is it has to come from the people. You have to have a combination of leadership in Washington that's willing to, you know, go about halfway. But I have also found that presidents cannot really even get through healthcare reform unless they have some sort of popular and especially a social movement behind them. I think there hasn't been enough credit given to the civil rights movement's role in the passage of Medicare. And then pushing LBJ to do what he did. So there has to be a convergence of political will and popular support. And you sound like you think we're getting there. I'm a little more cynical, but I think we have to try.
Nice reply. We may have to go through desperation first, unfortunately.
Yes, that's another factor.
Which we'll see.
Maybe I can make one quick one thing I think is very interesting is to describe the U.S. welfare state, or in particular the U.S. healthcare system, as very stingy is, I think, perhaps problematic. I think the statement you made, Rosemary, that 60% of healthcare services is government spending in the U.S., I think we really, really, really have to grapple with that. So it's not that we're actually spending quite a bit on the public side. But as a nation, we don't acknowledge it. We say that we have a private system and we need more public spending. Maybe it's just that we really need to reorganize, right? And that gets back to Rosemary's point. And a lot of people, a lot of middle class and upper middle class people do get a lot of public funding. So that's part of the picture. it's a question of redistribution, so that it's not just about we're too stingy.
I wanted to comment on the cultural thing that you observed about how managed care did not work because of the popular resistance to the management of people's care and the cultural wish that we have permitted in the United States for people to get what they want when they want it, particularly if they're privileged, and that's what dichotomizes those who are, as you say, in the Strozier Hospital and those who are getting all the rest of the care. So I would just emphasize this cultural problem and what strength of leadership that's going to require to change that. Mm-hmm. And as you say, possibly emergent situations. I'm not sure, but I alas, am a little pessimistic myself. But I would like to ask you to expand on what you think the American medical profession's role might be now, as a number of us have acknowledged that there have been changes. And there's a lot of salaried physicians, people who are choosing to be salaried. And I'm wondering how we might include them in the change that we haven't yet seen.
Well, I think one can answer that at two levels. One is that, as you know, many individual doctors are feeling really pressed in income as well as in what they see as being overregulated. There are problems in most many private practitioners working in very small groups, problems of privately investing in even in good computerized record systems. So there's a feeling of being beset among individual physicians, at least those in practice, which and not being hostile necessarily, but just be feeling beset. Can there not be something better? And they should be helped. I mean, there should be some way of putting physicians back in their rightful place. In a way, they've lost a lot of caste in the last couple of decades, and that's not good for healthcare. Nurses have been kind of rising in status in some ways, in many ways, and should. But doctors are sort of, many doctors feeling out on a limb. The other thing is what's happening in medical organizations. I've worked with a lot of medical organizations. What some of these medical organizations say, including the American College of Physicians, they're way, way out in front. In terms of social change, in terms of right to health care and comprehensive health insurance and so forth. So I think it's a very fruitful time. The problem with the medical profession is that there isn't a single organization anymore. I mean, the AMA represents a minority, I think now a small minority of practicing physicians. Because of specialization, everybody owes more allegiance to one or another special group. So, and different specialty groups traditionally you may have different kinds of approaches. Pediatricians have always been fairly liberal in their views organizationally, as a group, for example. So talking about the medical profession means that there has to be some working with lots of different organizations, and some of them are working together. The American College of Physicians Charter has been signed by a number of different specialty groups, and so I think the time is good for the medical profession, both in terms of the rank and file, although the rank and file probably needs some support. You've got a rank and file who feels their fees have been cut. Remember, Medicare and Medicaid came in where you were going to get your usual reasonable and customary fees. What's happened to that? That now means a schedule. So there's a lot to be done to bring back a responsible health profession, and not just the medical profession, nursing profession, and others at the national level as well, to try and thrash out what we can do. But this system doesn't work well. For many people, however, it does. Can I say my piece about some advantages of this system? Because why we haven't changed it in part is that because it does work well for some people, or they think it works well when they get care. And there is some coordination. I mean, government funds, federal funds, help start cancer centers. Well, cancer centers are pretty well provide pretty well coordinated care. Anybody here who's had cancer and been to a cancer center or been into being treated in a hospital, there's a lot of coordination that goes on in that care. I haven't seen a study done about how much of this is due to the federal funding that was provided a number of years ago and how far it was due to other reasons, but that's very interesting. And there are other examples where there are back centers, sleep centers, but these are all kind of splitters rather than joiners overall. There's been a huge, Medicare has had lots of successes. I mean, David Cutler has looked at some of these, The Economist, on looking at values added to the healthcare system over time. And, it's amazing how we just assume that knees and hips can be replaced, and even at advanced ages, and how surgery can be done. You know, my own mother-in-law, who is now 96, had a heart bypass surgery in her 80s. And that was inconceivable, I think, only a few decades ago. So there's a lot of confusion about looking at pluses and minuses throughout the system, and I do think we need a lot more of focus on things like what's happening in poorly run emergency rooms or overstressed emergency rooms, to get those anecdotes, that kind of information out into public view, because otherwise one keeps coming back and to people who say, "Well, my medical care is perfectly fine, thank you."
Okay. Why don't we take this as the last question, and then we will stop for lunch. Go ahead.
Thank you. Kind of comment and question. It seems that the safety net has failed, especially in certain social determinants. The overall health care, but access, education, housing, the whole deal of even what the World Health Organization represents as health has been failed in the past, even through when safety nets were set up formally and or informally, and they still struggle today. Moving forward with this reform, do you see the safety net capturing everyone and everyone be able to have access to the overall health system? And my comment is also, as long as there's disease detection and management at the core of healthcare and profit at healthcare. I mean, that's one of the challenges with payers and providers, and why so many people are in this quote-unquote game of healthcare is because it's a large revenue generation. The government putting more money into it makes people want to get further into it because there's revenues possible. So how do you see the determinants, social determinants, the safety net, this high profit area going into this reform, especially when you have concierge medicine taking a large role these days?
I just wanted to, respond to the first part of your question about whether the safety net will be part of healthcare reform. I think we kind of hinted at this earlier, but I think any system that has truly universal access will have to really, that concept can no longer be part of it because it implies a two-tier healthcare system, separate and unequal. And as Rosemary said, there's something peculiarly American about the whole concept of a safety net and that being necessary. So a system like single payer would not no longer require a safety net. And any system that has universal access at its core value will have to reflect exactly what Rosemary quoted Michael Davis as saying, which is fairness. And to me, that means more equity in terms of not having a bifurcated or two-tier system. And I'm not sure how to address the second part of your question because I think I missed it.
Well, I think this part of the second part of the question is, does a single payer system or the equivalent thereof, you know, you can have lots of different systems, payment systems, which together with under standard rules, do we also have to assume, and there's this old bugaboo of socialized medicine again, does it have to assume that there's a single model for the delivery of healthcare? And that would be terrible because we don't know really how to do it. I mean, we missed the opportunity with HMOs, but it was never really a viable prospect anyway because the money wasn't there. But you look at a system like the British National Health Service, which I grew up with in England, and they've been fighting year after year, decade after decade, reorganizing their national health service, trying to make it more responsive to markets and so forth. They would not claim. They've been trying to make it more diverse in terms of organization of care rather than more top-down. We don't know really how to do it. We may want lots of different kinds of models of healthcare, the actual healthcare delivery, in different places for different reasons and so forth. But again, to come back to what I said about the early thoughts about health maintenance organizations, we've got to have one heck of a lot of standardized information produced and research done so we can see better what works, so it's more transparent, so that we know what's going on. And at the moment, we actually don't. We've got people using lots of different kinds of healthcare. We don't have totally standardized systems, except for when you fill in those insurance forms after when the doctor fills in the insurance forms after a visit. We've got a lot of information, but it may not be the information we would want, or all of the information we would want to be able to evaluate how well a particular healthcare system works at the local area in ways that consumers could best use. And the ways that have been tried so far, I haven't found very helpful. They've been rather rudimentary. So we're talking about regulation, increased regulation, and increased standards, increased research. And in fact, the healthcare system is regulated, but it's not regulated as a healthcare system. It's regulated in terms of antitrust. It's regulated in terms of accreditation. You know, you name it. It's regulated in terms of fees and so forth. In terms of financing regulation, borrowing money and so forth. But we could do with a major push on how would you provide appropriate regulations for a healthcare system that would be useful to the provision of better healthcare.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rosemary and Beatrice. It was wonderful.